From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. The day after Election Day, a group of influential Utah Republicans gathered to reflect on what had happened. While Utahns as a whole overwhelmingly supported the GOP candidate Mitt Romney, why, they asked, did less than a quarter of Utah's Latinos support Romney? Was it Romney's statements on self-deportation? Was it the harsh rhetoric surrounding the DREAM Act? Was it the Republican roadblock against Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor? There's been a fair bit of hand-wringing on the subject, and today on the program, we're talking with Utah political insiders about how the two major political parties can better reach out to Utah's growing Latino population. Plus, the power of the pen and learning to use words to change the world. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. According to LatinoVoteMap.org, Utah saw a 65% increase in the growth of eligible Latino voters in the state since the year 2000. Yet just 24% of Utah's Latinos voted for GOP candidate Mitt Romney in this predominantly Republican state. So today on the program, we're talking about just what happened and how the two major political parties in the state will be making a pitch for Utah's growing Hispanic vote. Joining me in studio, Marco Diaz. He is state chair of the Utah Republican Hispanic Assembly, an official auxiliary of the Utah Republican Party. And Marco, great to have you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Jennifer. Thank you for having me.
Also in studio, Representative Rebecca Chavez-Hauck. She's a Democrat who has represented District 24, Salt Lake City's Avenues neighborhood in the Utah House since 2008. And Representative Chavez-Hauck, welcome to you.
Thanks, Jennifer.
And joining us by phone, Senator Stuart Reed. He's a Republican who represents District 18 in the Utah State Senate. His editorial, GOP and Hispanics, appeared in yesterday's Salt Lake Tribune. You can find a link to that on our website, kcpw.org. Again, joining us by phone from Ogden, and Senator Reed, good morning.
Good morning to you.
If you'd like to join our conversation, we're talking about the battle for the hearts and minds of Utah Latinos. Why didn't more Hispanic voters support Mitt Romney? If you're a Latino, what issues and political messages are resonating with you? You can join our conversation. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Marco, I guess I'll start with you. As I mentioned, just 23-24% of Latino voters nationally, pretty much the same margin here in Utah, voted for GOP candidate Mitt Romney. Were you surprised by that slim showing among Latino voters?
Yes and no. We knew the number was going to be low. We thought that it was necessary for Mitt Romney win at least 30% of the Hispanic vote in order to win the presidency. But we thought he was getting close. A national poll showed that he was getting up toward of that 28-30%. But when it came down, our numbers are slightly different. We thought we were between 25-27%. But it was definitely surprising that the numbers were so low. And it obviously sent a message, because with the economy being what it is, unemployment amongst Hispanics what it is, and really on the economic front, not a great picture for the Hispanic community, as well as the educational front, the fact that they still reelected the president, they still went out and voted for the president, sends a message that they rejected, despite the bad situation they're in, rejected the Republican nominee.
We'll certainly get to many specifics throughout the hour, but I mean, generally, what did Mitt Romney and the Republicans fail to do to bring in this vote?
Well, as we always talk in every Republican or in every presidential election, you know, both candidates run to their right or left, and then it's hard sometimes to get back to the middle. In this case specifically, because it was a very hard battled nomination process, Mitt Romney really had to go to the far right. And words like self-deportation and I will veto the DREAM Act was hard. I mean, it does not, Hispanics don't anticipate or expect that you agree with them on immigration on all front, but it's more of a welcoming message, or say, hey, let's focus on our commonalities. But that didn't send the greatest message. And then after he became the nominee, which, by the way, I'm very supportive, and it was very hard for me to take this loss, because I do believe he was a great candidate, a great man, but I think he had to go too far to the right and did not have a lot of time to convey that message. And even when he conveyed that message of, yes, I want to listen and I want to reach out, they didn't quite know who to believe at that point. And we need to do a much better job as a party reaching out way before the elections, not just during the elections.
Senator Reid, I want to bring you in. Is this a problem of communication, of messaging? Is that where the Republicans fell short, or is it flawed policy?
It's a combination of both. Clearly, when you send a message, in this case to the Hispanic community, that their interests are not your interests, you're not going to get their support. And as Marco just explained, Mitt Romney had to go to the right. Governor Perry from Texas, who was fairly moderate on Hispanic issues, when he made that fundamental decision, he sent a message throughout the country that Republicans, as the nominee of the Republican Party, are not supportive of the interests of the Hispanic community. There was a great debate, as I understand it, within his campaign, whether he should do that or not. Obviously, those who were opposed to him taking that very extreme position recognized that it would damage him severely in the general election, which it did. So the party has to understand the Hispanic community, this growing demographic. They need to address their interests and champion those interests. And they need to communicate, as I mentioned in my commentary in the Tribune yesterday, they need to communicate within the party. They need to educate themselves about the Hispanic community and how their values and interests align with the Republican Party, much more than people think. And they then need to also communicate outside the party that they welcome the Hispanic community inside the party and are willing and interested in supporting their concerns and the issues that confront that community.
As you point out in your commentary in the Tribune, this lackluster performance for the Republicans among Hispanics is quite a sea change from 2004, when former President George W. Bush got about 44% of the Hispanic vote. I mean, do you think that the Republican message has fundamentally changed since 2004?
Well, if you're going by the titular head of your party or the leadership of your party, that being the presidential nominee, when Mitt made that choice, he essentially sent a message to the country that Republicans were not interested in supporting Hispanic concerns. President Bush got it right. He won twice because he understood this important demographic group and that their interests were legitimate. They are obviously a very important community within this nation and frankly within this state. And all Republicans, all of us would be well advised to learn the lessons from President Bush. Mitt Romney would be the next president of the United States if he had learned that lesson from President Bush. If he'd gotten anywhere between 35% and 45% of the Hispanic vote, which is doable, he would be the next president of the United States. There's no question about that.
Representative Chavez-Hauca, a major factor in President Obama's reelection was his success in attracting Latino voters. Some were surprised by the showing for President Obama since he made this campaign promise in 2008 to push through comprehensive immigration reform. It has not happened yet. Why do you think the majority of Latinos were still willing to give the president a second chance?
Well, I think there are a number of factors at play, Jennifer. You know, first of all, there's an issue of consistency of track record. And I think that what Senator Reid brings up and also Marco about the consistency of messaging from the Republican Party has not been there. Whereas if you look at a party like ours, like the Democratic Party, we've been consistently on the side of pushing for comprehensive immigration reform. And I think what it is even at the end of the day, what Latino voters were looking at is, if I look at the track record consistently, even though those promises were not necessarily, they didn't come to fruition, is the intent still there? Do I still feel that connection, that relational connection with the candidate? You talk to people that market to Latinos a lot, and there's this issue of loyalty. There's this issue of relationship building with a constituency. And I think, although the Latino population isn't monolithic by any means, when you look at Latinos, they can tell if somebody is playing them. And I think that for the most part, they have, that there was probably a sense of, okay, which party do I feel is really authentic about what they're saying to me? Is it the one that went bouncing back and forth between 2004, 2008, and then back to 2010 with the Tea Party folks coming in and then being very vitriolic against our community? And now all of a sudden, 2012, they're not quite, this party doesn't really know how they feel about my community and how they feel about me? Or do I look at the track record of a party and of a candidate that tries, you know, their best to move forward towards comprehensive immigration reform? And also, you know, there were other issues that the president opted to take to the forefront, most notably the Affordable Care Act, which we also have to look at in many ways as a Latino issue. How many people now will be covered if they, you know, if we look at Medicaid expansion, if we look at preventative care, if we look at expansion of CHIP coverage, how many of those are Latino families? It's not lost on us that it's not just all about immigration and comprehensive immigration reform. It's how this party and how this president has carried forth an agenda of listening to our concerns as a Latino community and acting public policy-wise in our best interest.
But would you say that at the end of the day, was this a vote for President Obama and the Democrats, or was it a vote against what the Republican rhetoric was?
I really do think it's a little bit of both, because, again, if you look at the loyalty factor, Latinos say, who's been there for me through thick and thin? And then if they look at a Republican candidate that was waffling during the election, trying to pander to the more extreme elements of the more conservative folks who were very vitriolic against our community, and then felt himself moving back to maybe more of his authentic core more towards the end, I think that there was some question. And I think at the end of the day, I mean, I can't speak for each individual voter, but when they went into that polling booth, they said, okay, who has stuck with me through thick and thin, and who am I just not quite sure about?
Marco Diaz, you're not.
Yeah. We may have a little different perspective, because we as Republicans really thought that there was a great opening here. Why? Because President Obama had promised within his first 90 days that he would pass comprehensive immigration reform, or at least submit something. Throughout the entire first term, he did not submit anything initially in terms of a comprehensive immigration reform. Shortly before the election, about 6 months before the election, realizing that Hispanics were not that happy, unemployment was high, we still had some issues with education type issues, and realizing that he had deported more Hispanics than any president in U.S. history. Many Hispanic leaders, Democrat Hispanic leaders, went to the president and said, you have to do something because you're losing a lot of these votes, especially the enthusiasm to come out and vote for you. They may not vote for the Republican, but they may not come out and vote for you. So obviously he passed this executive order, which in our mind was a political move and more of a Band-Aid. But at least, again, he did something, right? And so we thought there was a big opening because his promises fell short. He promised a lot. He never showed up to a lot of his national Hispanic organization, many of which are Democrat organizations, meetings. And so there was a lot of talk, but not a lot of action towards the Hispanic community. That's why, as Republicans, we thought this is a great opening, a great opportunity. And as Senator Reid mentioned, if we were able to convey the message appropriately, we could have garnished more of that vote. We are under no illusion that we will ever capture the majority of the vote. But we don't need to capture the majority. If we consistently get between 35% and 40% of the Hispanic vote, which, as he mentioned, is very doable, we can consistently win these presidential elections in these especially key states. So I do believe that even though there has been some consistency on the Democratic part, this president has failed the Hispanic community. So I do believe that it was a more of a repudiation of the message, or the lack thereof, on the Republican side.
Stuart Reid, do you want to chime in here? Do you think this was a vote for the president or against Mitt Romney and the Republican platform, basically?
I think, frankly, both parties have failed the Hispanic community. We should have had comprehensive immigration policies in place years ago. We have failed in any leadership in terms of addressing these issues across the board. So I don't believe it was necessarily a support. One of the things that frustrates me in the aftermath of this is that some folks, particularly the very extreme right, are saying, well, the reason Hispanics voted for Obama was because they're takers, not makers. And when you address a community, a population in that way, you do nothing but alienate them. And it's just factually incorrect. For example, the Asian community, the Asian demographic, voted in the same way in this election for Obama as the Hispanics. And it is a fact that they have higher incomes even than Caucasians in this nation on average. Yet they voted for President Obama. They produce, in terms of their size in the population, they produce more business startups than any other segment of the population. Yet they voted for President Obama. And the reason being is that the way the Republicans, frankly, have approached these minority communities that are rapidly becoming the majority communities has alienated these communities to the extent that they feel almost afraid of our party, that we don't have their interests at heart, that our interests are with the white majority, which is, again, rapidly becoming the minority, and that they're not welcomed in the party. That has to completely change. And if it will change, then we can, frankly, benefit from those in the minority communities, namely, in this case, the Hispanic community. We can benefit from their values and their interests that are strongly aligned with the Republican Party.
Speaking
they
with...
tend to be more conservative in regards to family and moral issues. Their religious values are in harmony with the Republican Party political values. We can benefit from them, and then hopefully in the long term they can benefit from our effort to champion their concerns and interests as well.
We're speaking with State Senator Stuart Reed. He's a Republican representing District 18. Also with us in studio, Representative Rebecca Chavez-Hauk, a Democrat who represents District 24 in the Utah House, and Marco Diaz. He's the state chair of the Utah Republican Hispanic Assembly. Of course, we're still parsing out Election Day, talking about politics and Utah's Latino vote. If you'd like to join our conversation, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. We need to take a brief break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. Today on the program, we're talking about Latinos and politics. The number of eligible Latino voters is up 65% here in the state of Utah from 2000 to 2010. As Hispanics experience growing political clout, how are the two major political parties in the state reaching out to this demographic? Joining us this hour, Marco Diaz. He's state chair of the Utah Republican Hispanic Assembly. Also with us, Representative Rebecca Chavez-Hauk, a Democrat who represents District 24 in the Utah House, and State Senator Stuart Reed joining us by phone from his home in Ogden. I want to get some listeners in on the conversation. Let's go to the phones. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Let's go to Ben calling from Salt Lake City. Ben, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that the reason why I think Obama received such a high number of Latinos coming out to vote is because the Republican Party is, they may not be a racist party, but they're kind of read as a racist party. And also, it's, I think, it's because Obama was black, you know, like that wasn't just special for black people. It was special for like a lot of people of color, gave a lot of people hope. And so I think Obama is kind of an outliner. I think if it was just some regular white guy, it wouldn't have been as high of a percentage difference, even if everything happened the way that it happened on the Republican side.
Rebecca Chavez-Houck, minority voting for another minority, is that what's going on here?
You know, it doesn't always play out that way, but I think that what you see here is a story of common experience that may resonate with a lot of voters of different ethnic minority backgrounds. And it can't be discounted in any way. I think as we look at ourselves as a representative democracy and as our demographics change and we become more diverse, we seek to see that people that are representing us may have that common experience, may look like us, may have had the same struggles as many of us based on our ethnic background and that type of commonality. So I know that shouldn't be discounted at any rate. And I'm sure that in many ways for a lot of ethnic minority communities, there was that connection, that pursuit of American dream, that someone that from a very basic common background could pursue the office of President of the United States and achieve that.
Marco Diaz, I mean, do you think that Republicans in response are going to be recruiting a lot more minority candidates, whether they be Latino or not?
Well, I think they have already done so. I'm just surprised that this has been completely missed by the media, that the fact that that right now, over just the last couple of years, people are saying the Republican Party is going in a different direction. It's moving away. However, in just the last 2 years, we've had two senators elected from Florida and from Texas now to the Senate, U.S. Senate, both of which Hispanic. The first Latina governor in the history of the United States was not a Democrat, but a Republican, Susana Martinez. The first governor elected Hispanic governor elected in Nevada, Brian Sandoval, again, Hispanic. So we have four Hispanic, prominent young Hispanic leaders that the party has continually worked on recruiting good Hispanic leaders. What I think is missing is the messaging from the ground, meaning two quick things. One, I always say no one cares how much you know until they know how much you care. Very well known in Utah, this saying, but I think it applies to the Hispanic community. Hispanics, poll after poll shows that they don't vote for a party, but for a candidate. Now, they happen to vote more Democrat because they feel like these candidates maybe resonate more with them. But I believe our messaging, I don't think over this last couple of days, I've heard people over and over, we got to open up our platform more. We have to change our policies. No, I don't believe that. I believe just like Senator Reid said, I think there's a lot of commonality between the values and principles of the Hispanic community and that of the Republican platform. I believe we're not making a concerted effort to convey that message and reaching out and disavowing those voices, those extreme voices, and saying, no, that's not what our party is about. And showing the Hispanic community.
I have to interject here because the Republican Party platform that was adopted in August does oppose any form of amnesty. I mean, that's directly from the platform. It also it supports this idea of self-deportation, encouraging people who are not here legally to be on their way. That's in the platform.
Okay. In both the Utah platform as well as the national platform, there are varying voices within our party. The issue of immigration is one that, as you well said, in 2004, President Bush got 45% of the Hispanic vote, even though there were still some opposing voices in the party regarding this issue. The difference was that President Bush, which I believe it was a compassionate conservative, was able to articulate that even though there are varying voices within our party is one that cares and is willing to reach out to the Hispanic community. So, yes, even though there are things in both platforms that I think the Hispanic community may not always agree with 100%, I tell people you will never find a person, a candidate, a party that you agree 100% all the time. I don't agree with myself 100% of the time. However, I believe that is as a party, not that we have to reinvent ourselves or change our principles. If we convey that we care about this community, we're willing to reach out to them and even agree to disagree on some areas. But as we're able to do that, I think we will have find a welcoming, I think we'll have a more Hispanics, more receptive to this message, because those core principles of family, of self-governance, of traditional marriage, of a strong religious background are there, and there's a good base there.
Speaking with Marco Diaz, he's state chair of the Utah Republican Hispanic Assembly. Also with us, State Representative Rebecca Chavez-Hauck and State Senator Stuart Reed. We're talking about the Latino vote here in Utah. 801-355-TALK is our number if you'd like to join us. 801-355-8255. Rebecca?
Yes. You know, I just have to speak to a couple of things that Marco said. And I think that part of the challenge, in my humble opinion, that the Republican Party has had is what does the party look like at a local level? When you go to a caucus meeting or a mass meeting, do you see people who look like you there, and are, do you feel welcome there as a Latino or a person of color? Do you have people that are officers within your party structure? And, you know, we have Richard Jaramillo, who is chair of the Salt Lake County Democratic Party. You know, what do you commit with resources and time like the State Democratic Party did in terms of hiring a Latino outreach coordinator and putting money and time and effort to doing voter registration and coordinating caucuses and get going to car shows and meeting people? Again, it's that relational thing. And is the person that's talking to me about my party, do they look like me? Do they have my shared experiences? So I understand that there are some amazing people that are coming to the forefront, like Governor Martinez, that are I think going to start to change the face of the Republican Party, but it has to resonate all the way down the line to the grassroots level. And I think what you saw also with the Obama campaign is when people have someone come to their door and have a conversation with them and they look at that person in the face and they look like them, there's a big difference. There's something that resonates.
State Senator Stuart Reed, I'm wondering, what will this increasing Latino clout mean in the upcoming state legislative session? I mean, are you expecting to see bills about repealing the driver's card for non-resident aliens? I mean, what kind of legislation do you think is going to come out of the session, given what we've seen on Election Day?
Well, I hope that we're not going to see the repeal of some of those the pieces of legislation that we passed in the past in the legislature in support of and managing the whole immigration issue in the state of Utah. I think those between the Utah Compact and the HB 116, which I was the Senate sponsor for, I think we have done a better job in the state of Utah to let the Latino community know that that we do care. Governor Herbert recently said that one of the problems that we're facing in the party is that we're not perceived as a party that cares for those in the minority community or the people who are disadvantaged, people who are in the middle class that are struggling. And we need to change that. I think a really good image portrayal was at the acceptance speech of President Obama when he won the election, and the concession speech with Governor Romney. I noticed that in the audience, when they panned the audience a number of times, about every other person in the Obama acceptance speech rally were people of color. When they panned Romney's speech and the gathering there, there were very, very few people of color in that audience. It was almost all white, and just very, very limited numbers of those from the various minority communities. That has to change. That whole image and that visual has to change. And the only way that changes is if we reach out, and it's not just messaging, although that's very, very important. There has to be substantive efforts on the Republican Party's part to reach out to the Hispanic community and let them know that we represent their values and we want to represent their interests.
Let's go back to our callers. Excuse me. Let's go back to our callers. Gene is calling from Salt Lake City. Gene, hi.
Hi. Nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you.
I'm just calling because my wife and I were part of a of a group of many Utahns who went to Colorado and worked for Obama in Colorado, and by far the majority of the people, the first time we went, we were registering voters because of a variety of new laws put in by their attorney general. And so many had to be re-registered, which we were doing early. And then the last time we went was the day, the weekend before the election. And most of the people on my list, and we were actually targeting people who had mail-in ballots and had not returned them, and we were able to actually pick them up and put them in the county office for them. But they were felt completely disenfranchised by the Republican Party, and that and they were very pro-Obama. It wasn't just anti-Romney. However, I think the problem in Utah is really exemplified by, there's an article in the Tribune today called Headliner Republican Softening on Immigration, and reactions to that on the blog are really quite vile. And one of them said, the way to solve this problem is to ship them back home in cattle cars. And the other is, these are the vilest of criminals, and we should gather each one up and throw them out. And as long as you've got support like that in the Republican Party, you are never going to win the Hispanic vote.
Gene, I think it's some good points there. Thanks very much for the call. Marco Diaz.
Sure.
We were talking about national politics, now bringing it back home. I think Utah has done a great job. Utah Republicans have done a great job in the legislature to stand out amongst other red states. We are one of the most conservative states in the nation, yet we are the only state in the nation that has a driving privilege card, has in-state tuition, has a Utah compact that will and is being modeled in other states, that has HB 116. I challenge anyone to find a state that is, by, you know, through its legislature, has create an environment such that sends a message of, again, being a compassionate conservative state. However, as the caller mentions, there are extreme voices in our party. And what we need to do as a party, because I do not believe that is, especially in this state, the makeup of the majority of the Republicans in this state. However, they are loud, and we do not counteract that. Not that we have to agree on every issue, but we cannot seem as anti-Hispanic. You may disagree with me, a fellow Republican, on the issue of immigration. However, when that point comes across that you are not just anti-illegal immigration or anti-undocumented immigrant, but that you are, it comes across as anti-Hispanic, that is when we start losing the Hispanic vote, because even a person who is legally here, who has been born and raised here many generations, takes issue with that, saying, what? Now it becomes personal. And even if I agree with you on 8 out of 10 issues, again, no one cares how much you know until you know how much you care. And you don't have to agree with me. At least treat me as a friend, as a brother, as someone, as a citizen, right, of this country. Don't treat me with that guise of, you're all illegals, you're all trying to, you know, live off the government, when that is not the case. So I think we can win the policy argument if first we win the argument of, or at first, if we are more welcoming as a party. And I believe in Utah, that is the majority of Republicans. Unfortunately, the small but very vocal few speak very loudly.
Rebecca Chavez-Houck, I want to pose the same question that I put to Senator Reid. What will the increasing Latina voice mean in terms of the state legislative session? Do you expect to see a change of tone or bill proposals or anything of that sort?
Well, you know, both Senator Reid and I serve on the Commission for Immigration and Migration, and one of the things we've been trying to do over the past year is be very deliberative about how we approach public policy development surrounding immigration issues. And, you know, as of late, what we're doing is pursuing a very thorough, rigorous study of both the benefits and the challenges of immigration, both illegal and legal, and how do we accommodate these the demographic changes within our state. I also think this fits very well with another committee that I serve on with Senator Reid, who chairs the Economic Development Task Force for the legislature, a Multicultural Commission, which is another commission that the governor has convened and has a separate economic development arm in it, where we really start to look at beyond immigration issues and what do we do to celebrate, to integrate, to grow this changing demographic to the benefit of the broader Utah community. So how do we look at economic development and thinking about these emerging markets and these emerging communities and emerging business owners who might come from different backgrounds, who might be immigrants, who might be refugees? So, you know, I don't say that there's not going to be maybe some pushback by especially some new colleagues, given recent Supreme Court decisions regarding E-Verify possibly, and then also in regards to Arizona's SB 1070. But the fact that we have a commission that is specifically looking at immigration and trying to be very deliberative about it and not rush to judgment, I think says a lot, like Marco says, about how we approach immigration and our changing demographics in this state and in terms of public policy development.
We've only got a couple of minutes left. I'd like each of you to address the move ahead. I mean, what is the strategy going forward for Utah Democrats, Representative Rebecca Chavez-Hauck?
Well, again, like I mentioned, the fact that the party has already made a concerted effort by hiring a full-time Latino outreach coordinator during this past campaign, and it's my understanding that that intention will move forward. Because a lot of challenges that we've had in the past is we do an effort, and then it dissipates during the midterm. So we've got the momentum, the number of people that we recruited, the fact that we had 9 Latino candidates from the Democratic Party running in various offices throughout the state, and that some of them actually came very close, maybe within 4 points of winning their districts, says a lot that there's a foundation that's been built there, and we have that to move forward from. But I think there's a commitment from our party to continue to put resources as well as recruit individuals to help us move this agenda forward.
Senator Reid, about a minute. Moving forward.
I think we need to decide to do what is right, and the right thing is to reach out to the Hispanic community as Republicans. And gather in those that, frankly, need our support, want our support. And we need to address some of our internal problems and why we're not doing that, and then aggressively pursue that. And I think with the new leadership in the Senate, I think with our wonderful party chair leadership, I think we can do that and be successful, and I hope we will.
Marco Diaz, I'll give you the final word.
I'm a proud American, I'm a proud Republican, and a proud Hispanic. I believe there are a lot of people like me out there. We as a party need to do a better job reaching out to those folks. We need to do a better job reaching out to recent immigrants and helping them understand that the Republican Party does share their values and their principles. And so we cannot reach out to Hispanics 3 or 4 or 6 months before an election. This has to be an ongoing effort. They need to feel that this is not a political move, but a sincere effort to convey the message. As Ronald Reagan used to say, Hispanics are Republicans. They just don't realize it yet. We need to educate them. But more importantly, as I say, we need to embrace them. We don't have to agree all the time. No one ever is going to agree all the time, but we need to let them know, as also Ronald Reagan said, that this is a big tent, that there's diversity ideas, but that we share common values. That's why I say we don't need to completely reinvent ourselves. We just need to be more warm, more willing to embrace this community, and willing to speak against those harsh voices in our party that push away that Hispanic community.
Marco Diaz, he is state chair of the Utah Republican Hispanic Assembly. Marco, thanks so much for the time.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Representative Rebecca Chavez-Hauck, Democrat from District 24 in Salt Lake City. Representative, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And State Senator Stuart Reid, representing District 18 in the Senate. Senator, thank you very much for the time.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up next, Writing for Change, a conversation with Chip Ward. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce, and this is City Views. They say the pen is mightier than the sword, and an upcoming conference will reinforce that by focusing on the power of writing to effect social change. Today on the program, we're talking with environmental activist and writer Chip Ward about writing and pen and storytelling as a change agent. Chip Ward is a former political activist and former library administrator here in Salt Lake City. He co-founded the groups Families Against Incinerator Risk, Heal Utah, and other grassroots groups to raise awareness about the links between environmental quality and public health. He's appeared on CNN, the BBC, NPR, his many other outlets. His writings have appeared in The Washington Post, The LA Times, and again, many other publications. His books include Canaries on the Rim, about the power of citizen activism. And Chip Ward joins us by phone from his home in Torrey, Utah. Chip, hi. Thanks so much for your time.
Hi, Jennifer. Good morning.
Chip Ward is the keynote speaker at Utah Valley University's first conference on writing for social change. That's happening tomorrow, Tuesday, November 13th. It's a day-long event, and we'll give you more details on that as we go. But you can join our conversation this morning if you've written a letter to the editor or even posted a political missive on Facebook. Share your story. What is it about writing that attracts you? 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Chip Ward, you've written for years about the environment and other causes that you believe in deeply. When did you discover the power of words?
Well, actually, my writing developed in the context of the various campaigns that I was involved in to make polluters accountable. You know, if you're doing effective grassroots political work, you're really writing all the time. You're writing newsletters. I guess newsletters are actually sort of archaic at this point. It's probably a website or a blog at this point. Sure. But as letters to the editor, op-ed pieces, statements to be read at hearings, panels, debates, you're constantly writing pamphlets. And so most of my formative writing experiences were really done on the move in that context. They were often collaborative, often with a pretty unforgiving deadline. And over the years doing that, I just discovered that maybe I could just focus on that instead of all the phone calls and door knocking and so forth that go into political organizing.
Describe the way that writing is different from other outreach activities, social media, or taking to the streets, or as you mentioned, you know, the phone banking demonstrations, that kind of activity. How does writing differ, or does it?
Well, I'm not sure it differs all that much, except for that because it's written and it's captured in print or on a screen, you might have more time to process it or to go back and revisit it. It's powerful in that sense. It's not as ephemeral as, let's say, the spoken word. But here's a fairly basic understanding that I came to, and that is that the articulation of reality is really more primal than any policy or plan or project. That this is how we communicate as human beings. And even a vow of silence begins with some sort of discussion about it. And so, you know, words are all we have to outline for each other who we are, where we came from, where we're going, what we're capable of, what we like and dislike, and so forth. So words are powerful, and if you want to harness that power, you have to be fairly deliberate and intentional about it.
You've written about a whole range of topics, including the nuclear disaster at Fukushima, about fire in the West, about water in the West. How do you decide what to write about?
Well, these days I decide to write about what captures my interest. I'm in the luxurious position of not being, not having a career anymore. I'm retired, and I live down here in Torrey. I'm not involved in all the different campaigns that I used to be involved in. So I have a little bit more choice at this point. In the past, it was usually about whatever issue we were dealing with up north there where you are.
Speaking with Chip Ward, he is a writer, a former political activist. I would say you're still a political activist, also a former library administrator, and he is the keynote speaker at the Utah Valley University's first conference on writing for social change. Again, that's happening tomorrow, Tuesday, November 13th. It's a day-long event, and you can find out a lot more through the links on our website, kcpw.org. But if you'd like to join us, if you have questions or comments for Chip Ward, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. On your blog, you write that, quote, we spent the last two centuries learning how nature can create wealth. We will spend the next century learning how nature creates health. That clever turn of the phrase, I mean, how do you find the words that really capture something in a very short, accessible way?
Well, the difference between wealth and health, the two concepts, are kind of fascinate me. And, of course, we're not just talking about words. We're talking about how people express their values, how they make choices together, how we sort out our differences and so forth. But wealth always wealth encourages us to accumulate. Health encourages us to see how things flow. Wealth really assigns value. Health assumes value. Wealth says compete and conquer. Health says reciprocate, reconcile. Wealth manages and measures. Health usually is a little bit more free-flowing than that. It requires us to jam and dance a little bit. So there are really two different modes of being in the world, and I think that in the last 100 years we became very good at figuring out how to extract wealth from nature. What we're now learning is that nature also gives us health, and we have to figure out how it does that and not to get in the way.
So, for writing to be a very effective activist tool, I mean, you have to engage in the craft of writing. You have to, you know, put some complicated concepts into a very short, accessible phraseology. I mean, that I guess is where the art comes in, right?
Yeah, and I'm not sure you can teach that, though at UVU they're certainly trying to do that. I never had any formal background in learning how to write. I just did it on my own. But yes, that's it. Turning the phrase is the most important part. Today, unfortunately, everything is sort of soundbited, and I certainly had to learn to do that in order to deal with media when I was more politically active. You do lose a lot that way, but that seems to be the way we're going. Everything is in bullet points today. So that's the challenge. That's the one you meet.
You, in your essay, Dance, Don't Drive, Resilient Thinking in a Turbulent World, you write, quote, our civic discourse about sustainability needs to be reframed to convey its importance. I'm curious how writing can reframe a complete conversation on the community level.
Well, I think that we're doing that right now. Take the word sustainable. It's a pretty bloodless word. I think that when people hear that our current civilization, our current economy is unsustainable, it's pretty anesthetizing. If you really look at what the word means, it means whatever is not sustainable eventually collapses. And so that's pretty serious business. If our economy should collapse, or if our civilization should collapse, so I think that we need to reframe the discussion to talk more about the implications of what it means to live in an unsustainable world. What could happen, and how you avoid that.
So you mentioned that you will be teaching this course down at UVU, and it's difficult to teach someone how to write persuasively. What are some of the tips you're going to be mentioning tomorrow?
Well, I think for people who are writing for social change, and I think that most of those folks are involved with the Center for Peace and Justice down there at UVU, so they probably have some of the same concerns that I do. And I would just say, you don't write from outside of the struggle. Find what cause stirs your passion, what you're really interested in. Get involved, roll up your sleeves, and then have your writing serve that end. We sometimes treat writing as if the whole goal is to be published somewhere, and that's very nice, but really if you're trying to affect change, you're really influencing people, reaching them where they are, and serving a cause.
What writers out there today are doing this in ways that you find compelling and interesting?
Well, I think Bill McKibben is writing some very powerful stuff about climate change. I read Michael Pollan to understand about food. My friend Rebecca Solnit, I think, has got a number of great takes on what's going on today. She has two recent essays at TomDispatch.com, which I think are very good. And then, of course, it's not just all nonfiction political writing. There are people who are writing creatively. Mary Dixon's play about being a downwinder is a very powerful example of how a play can influence your view of the world. We need all kinds of writing. It's a very diverse world out there, and a lot of diverse people. And you write to fill a niche.
Chip Ward, he is a writer, a political activist, and a former library administrator, author of the book Canaries on the Rim. He will be the keynote speaker at Utah Valley University's first conference on writing for social change tomorrow, Tuesday, November 13th. You can find out a lot more through some links on our website, kcpw.org. Chip Ward joining us by phone from his home in Torrey, Utah. Chip, thanks so much for the time.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
City Views is a production of KCPW in Salt Lake City. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. Coming up tomorrow, understanding Muslim societies. We'll hear from an expert on that. Also, acclaimed pianist Leslie Howard. So join us for those conversations tomorrow morning at 9. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.